and welcome to the Forbes India Cover Story podcast series in association with theindycars.com. My name is Abhishek, and this package is Forbes India's annual luxury issue. And joining me on the call to talk about it is Forbes India's Pankti Mehta Kadakia. Hi, Pankti. Thanks again, and it's great to have you back.
Hi, Abhishek. Great to be back and speak with you again.
Thank you. And you say in the rubric or the strap in the opening essay, and the cover itself is, can India become the next China? So let's start with first understanding how big the market in India is.
To put some context to that, we know that India's economy has been growing quite well recently compared to other major economies in the world. But to put some numbers to that, a Bain report says that India's luxury market could reach $200 billion by 2030. It estimates that it could grow 3.5 times its current size. And this is because of a lot of factors, including that we've seen reports of the ultra high net worth individuals rising, the number of entrepreneurs increasing, seeing a strong middle class emerge. We're seeing more demand from tier two and tier three cities. A lot of it is to do with technology, better access. Yeah, so I think all in all, India's luxury industry is quite well poised to grow.
And you talked about the economy. So investment banking bust back in 2008 to 10. Later, you had COVID a decade later. Do you see any correlation between the two?
Yeah, so I think there was a definite dip during the COVID years. But we've seen a report that says the luxury market, in fact, has fully recovered from the COVID crisis. So it's grown 8 to 10% over 2019 just this year. And this, I'm talking about the global luxury market. And India is actually one of the bright spots in that sort of report. So China has not grown as well as it used to. And because of prolonged COVID lockdowns and other factors, China is still sort of struggling with its economy, and its luxury market shows similar patterns. But we've seen that India and also other Asian countries like South Korea, for instance, have made quite a robust comeback.
And the cover that you have written on the lines of how, and I love the title as such, which says Lehengas in the Boardroom. What is that about? To give a little bit of an overview.
Sure. So I wanted to look at how, well, the Indian fashion wear market, the Indian ethnic wear market has been fragmented for a while. And we know that the wedding market is massive in India. And a lot of these fashion houses like Manish Malhotra, Sabyasachi, Abu Jani, Sandeep Khosla, for instance, have existed for a long time and have dominated the market for a long time as well. But I think in the last couple of years, where finally this sector is getting some sort of organization with corporate interests. So big conglomerates like the Aditya Birla Group and like Reliance Industries have made investments in these firms. And they're looking to scale them to something we haven't seen before. We're looking at global expansion and also this sort of funding infusion in the luxury ethnic wear market that we haven't seen before. So we're seeing a definite shift in the way that the fashion industry is functioning. So that's basically what the story is looking at.
And is this new? You talked about the unorganized sector, which has been around for a long time, but is this change more recent where conglomerates or even family houses have now started putting in money? With a couple of examples that you gave, Aditya Birla, Reliance and the like.
There have investors in the past, of course, but those have been more in individual capacities. I think this is the first time we're seeing like concerted systemic efforts. All of these investments happened after 2021. So it's as recent as 2 years old. A big reason is that the Indian consumer has also changed, and the market is, I think, at a point of maturity where we are finally taking pride in Indian fashion, for instance, in things that are made in India. And that's not just relegated to fashion either. They're seeing huge potential in the NRI market. So in markets like the UAE, for instance, or even New York or London, that are DC hotspots, so to say. I don't think they are expecting to draw in a foreign audience with these investments and with this sort of scale, but they are definitely looking at capturing a lot of the NRI market. And they're also looking at building luxury brand houses like you see with Europe. So if you see like a Chanel or a Dior, they're doing all sorts of things, right? They're making clothes, but they're also making accessories, they're making shoes, they're making all sorts of things. So we're sort of seeing that diversification in our luxury ethnic wear brands as well. So for instance, Manish Malhotra, Sabyasachi both do jewelry now. Rahul Mishra is looking to do bag shoes. So yeah, we're seeing a sort of more organized luxury house format versus just an individual, you know, wedding wear brand, bridal wear brand.
And the NRI audience that you talked about, is that why, you know, some of these are going global? I think you're right that Manish Malhotra has, I think, a flagship store which might launch or has launched in Dubai. And then you have Sabyasachi's 6,000 square feet at New York.
Yeah, so that's exactly what they're trying to do with the global stores. And in the Middle East, in fact, I think there's potential to also attract some of the local population because their dressing style obviously is similar to ours and they might find occasions where they are wearing ethnic outfits like we do. But in the West, it's more about capturing that NRI market that would otherwise have to fly to India to shop for weddings, for instance, which a lot of them do. And if you see, I've also mentioned the story of Purple Style Labs in this story, which acquired Ponya's pop-up shop a few years ago. And Ponya's pop-up shop is this multi-designer luxury, which started off as an e-commerce site. But now, yeah, so now it has offline retail formats. They're also looking at stores in New York, London, the Middle East, and hopefully in other parts of the world as well. But yeah, the sense I get is that they're not looking to expand for some of their couture or ready-to-wear or evening wear Western sort of lines. I think the focus is still very much on their ethnic fashion and getting the NRI market for that, because with their Western wear, they would obviously be competing with the Chanels and the Diors of the world. And they don't know if that makes business sense at this point. So Rahul Mishra, in fact, talks about how if you want to offer something at the same price, your product needs to be at least 20 times better than what a Dior is offering, for instance, right? So yeah, competing on that footing may not make as much sense. But I think if we know who our market is, then there's a good chance for these brands to scale well.
Right. And usually with these brands, they are very strongly associated with the designer, whether it's Manish Malhotra or Sabyasachi. How do these folks build brands that will outlast them?
Yeah, so we do speak about that. And I think what Masaba said to me was quite interesting. She said that beyond a point, there is something called a founder's exhaustion that kicks in. You've brought the brand up to a certain level, but beyond a point, you do need to bring in, whether it's creative voices or business heads or people who really know how to scale businesses on board to sort of take the brand to the next level, right? So I think a lot of it is to do with building a strong foundation, a strong team, and knowing who the best partners are to fulfill your purpose, so to say. And again, we look to the European luxury houses as examples of that. We've mentioned how Donna Karan had to leave her own brand, even though the brand is still named after her. A lot of these European brands where you don't really know who the creative director is anymore. So I think if you have a strong design lab, built systems that allow for you to sort of take a backseat, I think that is the ultimate goal with this sort of corporatization.
Now, Leanne, to segue into another story that you've done on expensive wines, and usually our mind goes to, say, France or a few other countries in Europe, but you've done one on Ipsita Das. You've interviewed the managing director of Moët Hennessy India. It has an India connection with Nasik being the place where the wine comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been interesting to see how that works. So it's the story is about Sean's new launch. It's called Orva, which is Sanskrit for off the earth. So Chanel has always been known for its sparkling wine. So for the first time in its history, it's made a still wine, and that's made in India, in Nashik. And they talk about how this was innovation, obviously in the winemaking process itself, but also in the management of the vineyard, because obviously our climate is different. We have a lot more intense heat, intense sunlight. So the way that the grapes were grown had to be different. Yeah, I think, as we said earlier, that there's a lot of pride in made in India produce now. And it will be interesting to see how all of these industries sort of can tap into that and innovate products for the world. So Orva is a small batch wine, I think, to begin with. So it will be available here as well as Australia. And then they're hoping to take it to other parts of the other wine growing regions of the world later as well. But they say that their purpose is for it to be showcased as a luxury wine from India to the world.
Lovely. And to wind this up, any other stories that you think might interest the readers?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty nicely packed edition. We have a great story on a private jet tour, which is sort of a first of its kind, where you can basically take like a long tour on a private jet, which offers you sort of exclusive experiences in very unique destinations. Mm-hmm. So that's an entirely new experience. Then there's a really nice story on how homegrown chocolates are getting more luxurious. We've always looked to other parts of the world and imported chocolates, even for gifting purposes and otherwise. But yeah, there's a whole like bean to bar movement happening within India itself, where chocolate makers are getting more artisanal and more experiential in the way that they serve chocolates. That's a really interesting story. We're looking at homegrown whiskies for travel. There's a bunch of luxury homestays within India that offer really exciting experience. That's a nice read as well. So there's a lot to back into this issue.
Lovely. Thank you very much for your time, Pankti, on this podcast. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All your listeners, you can get this podcast on ForbesIndia.com or any other app that you use to download your podcasts. And to have someone call you for a Forbes India subscription, message Forbes to 51818.